This episode of The J. Rose Show briefly mentions Charlie Munger, but the episode was recorded shortly before Charlie Munger passed away. Charlie was a great investor, business builder, teacher, and more. He will be deeply missed, but his legacy will live on.
Welcome to The J. Rose Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J. Rose Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now, please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is The J. Rose Show, a podcast that explores what it takes to achieve mastery, sustained performance, and longevity. The show hopes to uncover the processes, structures, frameworks, and mindsets that masters put in place to maintain winning performance in their respective fields. Today, I am joined by Christopher Blumstrand. Chris is the founder, president, and chief investment officer of Semper Augustus Investments. In addition to his great investing performance, Chris is known for his long, deep dive letters that break down every aspect of Berkshire Hathaway's business. I can say with confidence that Chris is one of a handful of analysts in the world that understand Berkshire Hathaway and educate the world on its performance and prospects better than anybody else. I'm thrilled and grateful to learn from Chris today. Chris, welcome to the show.
John, thanks for having me. I listened to your first two episodes with Nygren and O'Keefe, and I thought they were both terrific. So it's an honor to be on the show with you today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. That made my day for sure. Chris, tell us about Semper Augustus.
Oh boy, we're celebrating, in fact, just finished our 25th year as a money manager. Chad and I started the firm at the end of 98, so we're into our 26th. I've been doing this for, oh Lordy, a third of a century. Semper's, we run money for individuals, family offices, some institutions, pretty good mix between institutional money and individual money. We run long horizon, long duration, concentrated equity portfolios. And we think we do some things perhaps a little differently than what you define as your classic value investor. We try to be a little opportunistic, but just thrilled for our clients who have been with us for so many years.
That's a great intro. So you said long duration, concentrated equity investing, but you also try to be a little opportunistic. Maybe we can dive in just a little bit more. What type of investor are you? What is your investing philosophy? How would you describe yourself as an investor?
Well, I really dislike labels. The value or growth, to me, growth is part of the value equation.
Yep.
I think if anything, you'd say that we're opportunistic. Opportunistic value investors, for lack of a better definition, with an eye toward management integrity, balance sheet integrity, in places you're looking for the durable moat around a business, but you're also looking for places where you haven't had a moat, but things might be changing. And so we're opportunistic. We do a lot of different things, and I think all with an eye toward the management of risk at bottom.
How do you define opportunistic? What does that look like in your portfolio?
Well, you're trying to make money at the end of the day. Opportunistic to me would be identifying industries and businesses where change is afoot. You know, we bought a couple of refiners, and I'd never owned a refinery or refiners prior to the fall of 2020, but the energy component of the S&P got down to almost nothing, Maybe 1.5%. And we developed scarcities in refining capacity through the outright closure of refining capacity in the West. And so structurally, these wildly cyclical businesses with profitability that reverts to or even below at times a cost of capital, a couple of businesses, really the industry, but a couple in particular, where we found management quality to be better than some of the others, and some structural advantaged assets from a competitive standpoint, just too cheap to pass up, and the businesses got better. We own Olin, a commodity chemical company here in St. Louis. The business got better through a rationality of Western capacity. China is an issue at the moment, but you really did. It's finding things where you've got change that's not widely recognized by the overall investment community. It will do special situations at times. You know, some things will cross your desk. You know, we bought Apollo Investment Corp years ago, which came as a mezzanine, as a mezzanine fund, a BDC, came at 15. Nobody wanted to own it at the outset. The stock traded below what was all cash in the business. So we paid 13 and change per share for a business that had about $14.10 in cash.
Wow.
On an IPO. They were going to put a bunch of money to work, maybe, you know, lever it up 2-to-1. So maybe take $600 or $700 million, whatever it was, run it up to $1.5 billion in mezzanine debt that was at the time yielding low teens. Between here and there, they were going to own some just higher quality corporate paper. Didn't have any notion or any desire to own a mezzanine lender. We'd shy away from leverage, but you saw a runway for a few years where they would deploy the capital. And, you know, when you make a mezz loan, you make any loan, it's generally not going to default on day one. So you had a grace period, if you will, before the loan book would conceivably go bad, which a lot of it did. And, you know, we saw a couple bucks plus in earning power, and again, bought this thing for a little over $13 and sold it within a couple of years, kind of in the mid to, you know, we call it mid 20s. And it was almost at the outset, it was risk-free money. It was literally all cash in the business, no other assets, which you were buying at 90 cents on the dollar, and a whole lot of intermediate term upside. And since then, the thing essentially failed. They've done a reverse stock split. They rebranded it. It's now under a different name, but you can still find it. Mm-hmm. So long-term, the thing was a disaster, but you know, there was a window there where it was really no downside and a whole lot of upside for a short period of time. And, you know, I think a lot of folks wouldn't have done that or couldn't have done that. And we saw it and did it very quickly. So I'd throw the opportunistic tag on that, I guess, if you will.
I was just going to say that is an excellent example of opportunistic or special situation investing. So thank you for that. So we've been on, you know, maybe 5 or 6, 7 minutes now, and you've mentioned moats and you mentioned structurally advantaged assets when referring to those refiners. You also mentioned that sometimes you'll maybe take a position in a company that's in the process of building a moat, that's at an inflection point. So I'm just curious, for the most part, would you call yourself an economic castle protected by a wide moat type of investor?
Gosh, I don't know. That's a long description.
I got that from Buffett, as you know.
So yeah, I think to a degree, sure. You know, I don't want to be in anything where you don't have some kind of durable advantage or an evolving durable advantage. You know, ideally, we'd love to have a portfolio of companies that were monopolists or oligopolists and industries behaving rationally with good economic returns and a permanence to the business, something that couldn't be disrupted. Rarely is that the case. To me, you can't deviate from working with people owning businesses that are run by honest people. Mm-hmm. Just an enormous amount of charlatan behavior in the last cycle. not unlike what we saw in the late 90s. I think when you stretch on leverage, you can get yourself into trouble during economic downturns. And that's not to say we won't tolerate a business that has leverage in the corporate structure and the capital structure. You know, a lot of times businesses that are doing deals, making acquisitions, for example, will put debt on the books, but then you want to see them bring their leverage ratios back down to a manageable level. And as long as you've got a blueprint for doing so, you know, we'll put some businesses with leverage in the portfolio, but you know, generally we're going to shy away from very high leverage. We're going to shy away from management teams that stretch. I've talked in the past, we owned and we made a whole bunch of money in pharma. There was a piece of legislation in 1984, Hatch-Waxman, which really enforced patent life in branded drugs. At the time, you had maybe 10% of all prescriptions that were written in this country were for generics. And now you've got something like 90%. So you had a huge tailwind behind the generics industry. And we owned Mylan Labs and made a mountain of money. But at a point, we didn't really like the business. We didn't like the management team. We didn't like the fact that you won and lost in the courtroom and not in the lab. There were some abuses really on the compensation of management. The business was run by a founder who we had issues with. And so ultimately, even though you still had some upside in the shares, we just parted company because we really didn't like the people running the company. So you've got to keep your business quality and your management quality high. And so whether you're in a cyclical, whether you're in an opportunity, you really can't deviate from that. You know, there's too much room for error in investing. And so keeping those characteristics aligned, I think, serves to keep you out of trouble at times.
Definitely. What does your typical stock holding look like? Maybe what's the typical multiple it trades at? You know, typical return on equity profile. Is a company typically buying back a lot of stock or paying a dividend? Maybe a better way to ask this is, can you share some portfolio level metrics with us, such as the average return on equity or average PE ratio of the portfolio?
Yeah, I think to look at it through the lens of the individual companies is tough because you've got a big range.
Sure.
But I do this in my letter every year, which you've read and you can see it in detail. We update our portfolio fundamentals on a quarterly basis. I mean, it's pretty wild at the moment in that you've really got, with the exception of maybe 08, 09 and the early part of the pandemic in March of 2020, you know, we've not had a portfolio trading at such a deep discount to what we'd call intrinsic value. At September 30, Lordy, we had a multiple just over 9 to earnings. So we had nearly an 11% earnings yield. You know, your market was trading and is trading at north of 20 to earnings. So you've got less than a 5% earnings yield. So we were really half the value there. We were at 1.4 or 1.5 to book against over 4 for the index. On a price to sales basis, the portfolio rarely has been less than 1x, and we were at 90% of sales.
Wow.
Against 250%. We're kind of 6 or 7 to cash flow against 14 or 15 dividend yield. And here's where the metrics get interesting. We were almost 2% dividend yield against, I think at September 30, the S&P was 1.6, might've been 1.7. But we have a payout of the proportion of earnings in aggregate for our portfolio. We've got about 18% of profits paid to us as dividends. So you've got 82% of profits reinvested at an average portfolio return on equity of about 15.5%.
Wow.
And because our businesses employ so little leverage, you know, nearly as much, net debt to equity is under 10% at the moment. You know, you've got really in the S&P 500, a like amount of equity and debt in the capital structure.
Yep.
And so there for the index trading at over 20 to earnings, you've got about a 35%, let's call it payout rate. But you had a lower dividend yield. So I've got, you know, kind of half the payout. I've got half the payout rate but a higher dividend yield. And that's a reflection of the overall valuation of the portfolio. And I think the real advantage you hit on are your companies buying back stock. A lot do. And I like to think the ones that do are doing it for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. If you own the index, you've got 2/3 of your profits reinvested by managements. And for the last 20 years, none of those profits are doing anything other than repurchasing shares in the market. And they're doing it to offset the dilution that comes by giving away 2% on average of the company per year to executives and upper management. And so when you're paying over 20 to earnings, the profits for the index are being reinvested at the earnings yield at 5%. It's such an enormous advantage to be able to find businesses that can reinvest at mid-teens returns. But then I've got companies like an Olin, which is situated in really an oligopoly, where nobody in the West, sans China, hold China and India out, but nobody in the West is going to add capacity. Mm-hmm. And so if you can't reinvest in the business, you either want to be paying dividends, and they've paid they're a dividend aristocrat. They've paid a regular dividend since the 1930s, but the stock's trading at 5 or 6 to earnings. So wow. You've got almost a 20% earnings yield. So what are they doing? Well, in the last year and a half, 2 years, they've taken the share count from 165 million to nearly 120 million shares. This thing could be private in 5 or 6 years. That's exactly what you want a company to do. Sans the ability to reinvest in the business. Now, if the stock were trading at 40 to earnings and earnings weren't depressed, the last thing you would want would be a repurchase of shares. So really, you've got to get management's understanding of what their business is worth and a sense of the limited capital allocation levers that a management team can pull. And we spend a lot of time trying to ensure that the managers of the companies that we own understand the capital levers and employ them properly.
Yeah, I have always said, Chris, that when you have a good company run by a good management team, buying back stock at 5x earnings, things will work out over time. And that's, I have found, all joking aside, that has usually been the case. Super, super interesting. Like you said, almost wild to hear your portfolio metrics trading.
Well, a caveat on your point. I mean, a lot of times things will trade at a low multiple because they're not great businesses.
Absolutely.
They don't grow. They're in decline. So you've got to be careful there. I mean, the last thing you want is a large share repurchase program for a business that's in decline. Now, yep. If you've got a durable business and it's trading at a cheap price, sure, you want them buying the heck out of the stock. But if you've got a declining business and you're milking assets for a period of time and you're headed toward the dustbin of history, to the extent you're generating cash, send it out the door as dividends and special dividends. So there's a nuance to cheapness. Cheap is not always reflective of inferior business quality, but a lot of times it's reflective of inferior business quality. You've got to be able to delineate there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's got to be a good, like you said, durable business. But wow, just wild. Your portfolio has an average return on equity of 15%. Very low dividend payout ratio, high earnings reinvestment rate, and trading at only 9x earnings, 7x cash flow, less than 1x price to sales. Does that excite you as a portfolio manager that your portfolio is trading at such a discount to what you believe is intrinsic value?
Well, it does. I'm one of the few that gets excited when you see nothing but red.
Yep, absolutely.
On your screen and declining prices. I mean, essentially, you really only want your stocks trading at high prices if you want to trim them or at the moment in time where you need the money. If retained earnings and the repurchase of shares is an intelligent corporate action, the last thing you want is a high stock price. You want a low stock price.
Yep.
And so, you look at the market for the last couple of years and you look at our portfolio returns. We made about 1% last year. I'm going to say today were probably up, I'm going to guess 6 or 7 or 8% for the year. We were flat for the year at September 30. So you've had a big run here in the overall markets, but you've had a bear market in the majority of stocks, both here and abroad, for the last couple of years. And that's masked this year, of course, by everybody's now familiar and with what's has become fashionably known as the Magnificent Seven. But you go back to the Fab Five, there are really 30 or 40 companies that are driving the bus this year on valuation. You've got the median stock down something like 25%. Yep. Your small cap indices are flat to negative. Your mid cap indices are flat to negative. You've got a whole bunch of industries that are down for the year. And so under the hood, you've got an enormous amount of value. There are more businesses that are buyable today than we've seen kind of in the universe of companies that we follow. And so you can be selective and own what you want to own, but the opportunity set is growing because the market's been so weak. Even linking, if the S&P was down 18% last year on a total return basis, and let's say it's up 18% this year, you're still negative. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you decline 50 and make 50, you're not back to even.
You're not back to even. Yep.
So on a down 18 and an up 18, you're still down. And some of those Magnificent Seven are still negative if you go back to December 31, 2021. But what's happened to the average stock is pretty remarkable. I think the economy is probably weaker than people think it is. You see volumes across myriad industries weak to negative in the last couple of years. You look at rail car loadings, volumes are down. You see it you're starting to see trucking roll over a little bit. And so I love it. I mean, I love when things are cheap, but even in a portfolio of 25 companies, let's say, where we tilt to where we've got almost 80% of our capital in our 10 biggest holdings. Mm-hmm. And Berkshire skews that at north of 20%. And Berkshire also skews the payout rate, because if you've got a portfolio holding at 20%+ that doesn't pay a dividend, you know, that's going to push on the payout rate, of course. But I've got 15 of our 25 stocks that are trading at prices where you just have to pinch yourself. And, clients are making deposits and sending money in, or new clients are coming in the door. The ability to put money to work today is pretty attractive. And, I just like these times when a whole bunch of what you'd like to own or that you own is cheap, because we always have cash flows. You've always got dividends coming into the portfolio. To the extent I'm trimming things that are expensive, you just want cheap asset prices. And we happen to be at a time where it feels like the market's doing well, but the market of stocks on an equal weighted basis is not the same as a cap weighted basis. I think few investors would know that at the outset of this year, the seven big stocks, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Meta, Tesla, and now Tesla and Nvidia were 21% of the S&P 500. Today, they're over 31%. They've added 10 full points. You had, something like $5.5-6 trillion of market value added this year, and all but a trillion of it is in those seven companies, and they're all trading it in aggregate well over 30 times earnings, some wildly more expensive than that. So you've got a real concentration of overvaluation. And that reminds me a lot of what happened in the late 90s, where you had the underbelly of the market was really cheap. We had a portfolio that was trading at a higher multiple, almost 15, but the S&P was trading at close to 40 times at that point. And, but there were companies in the portfolio that were trading at 5, 6, 7, 8 times. And it was easy to buy those things because nobody wanted to own them. So I'm seeing a lot of parallels. I love it when most of what we own has been in decline, because we always have cash to put to work.
As you are a card holding opportunistic value investor, I want to focus some time on how you think about valuation. Are you building discounted cash flows? Are you using normalized sort of mid-cycle PE ratios? Are you looking at free cash flow yields? Or how are you thinking about valuation?
So when I'm asked to speak at universities throughout the year each year, and really enjoy that. I enjoy spending time with young investors. If ever asked about whether I run DCFs, I tell the professors in the room to cover their ears.
Yeah.
And explain that I've never run a DCF as a professional investor. You ran them in school, studying corporate finance, and they were always kind of done in a project based setting.
Yep.
I think modeling is a challenging thing, in that you can fool yourself by tweaking the long run terminal growth rate, for example. I think the notion of measuring cost of capital on the equity side that has a beta component to it is absolute insanity.
Yep.
I think how do you go about selecting the appropriate discount rate? Do you apply it to the entire market? And so, no, valuations come to me over the years. Early on, it was just kind of the classic, without thinking about the nuances between one business or another business, or one industry and another industry. You measure things on a price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to sales, price to book, dividend yield basis in the absolute. The nuance of any individual company you're studying, or that you own or you'd like to own or not own, you've really got to think deeply about the components of what goes into the DCF. Mm-hmm. Growth, for example, what is G? I mean, does it come from the reinvestment of earnings? Does it come from the use of new capital, leverage, equity capital? Do you have volume growth? Do you have pricing power? There's so much that goes into growth that you know, simply plugging a number into a model, can serve to fool the modeler. But you've got to think really deeply about where growth comes from. You got to think deeply about where profitability comes from. You think about free cash. Well, oftentimes, the best businesses that are in a growth mode, that are opening new stores, for example, in the retail world, you know, if you're opening boxes at 20-point returns on capital and you've got a runway to do that for a long period of time, then continue to open boxes as fast as you can. And you want CapEx.
Yeah, you don't want any free cash flow if they're generating those sorts of returns on capital.
Absolutely. If you've got the ability to reinvest it, then reinvest it. So I think your classic metrics have utility, but you've really got to understand how to use them. And I think just a third of a century in, if we've done anything well, it's understanding what each of those metrics actually mean. For that, we don't run DCFs, but price matters. And so, you know, we're sitting here talking about price to earnings. Well, that's critically important, but you've got to understand whether your profitability is depressed, whether it's at a normal level, whether it serves to expand. Nike in the last handful of years, you know, they're suffering a little bit, but, you know, Nike's taking distribution through their apps. And for that, you know, they're kind of in the process over time, cutting out classic distribution with some of their retail partners. And if you're pricing at the same price point online through your app as the price of a pair of sneakers or apparel in the stores, more of that margin is inuring for your benefit. And so you've got a place where you've got over time rising profitability. So you take today's earnings and look at where they're going to wind up being in 5 or 10 years out. Well, how much volume growth do you have? How much pricing power do you have? But at the same time, you've got a place where margins should be growing. That's hard to do. But you've got to get away from a formulaic approach to be able to think about things like that. You're just not running screens based on valuation and buying the 20 cheapest names that pop out on a screen. You know, that can work. And I think if anything, the value world has a long-term advantage, because a low price generally is going to correlate to decent returns. I mean, if you're in the game of only buying growth businesses and you disregard business quality or you disregard price, the purchase of a really good growing business at a price that makes no sense can just kill your return. I've talked about Microsoft. I wrote about Microsoft in my January 1, 2000 letter. And I've talked about this on several podcasts and I've included it in the letter, but it's a healthy example. You know, Microsoft was the largest publicly traded stock by market cap in the late 90s, early 2000. On January 1, 2000, it sported a $620 billion market value. The stock had been public for 14 years and had compounded at 60%+. Well, the business was wonderful. It was doing a 38% profit margin with nearly infinite returns on capital. Business did not require a lot of capital. So you had $7.5 billion, let's call it, in profit and $20 billion in revenues, but you were paying 31 times sales. And only for the valuation did I write that the shareholders would lose money for 15 years, which on a total return basis, they did. Even when they paid their first special dividend and started paying regular dividends, the stock was 15 years ahead of itself. And even from that point through today, where it's risen back to the second largest company next to Apple, their profit margins, which had dropped into the low 20s, have recovered now to the mid 30s. They're nearly back to where they were in 1999. And the stock's gotten ahead, more likely than not, ahead of itself again. But from that moment in 2000, you've only had a single digit return. You've earned 8 or 9%. And it's taken this big bull market in the last decade to drive the thing up from where it hadn't been at moments. For a fair portion of that 15 years, it was a negative return. The stock was way below where it was on January 1, 2000. In fact, 7-8 years after we wrote that in our series of predictions in that year's letter, we became shareholders of Microsoft. But I didn't pay 80 times earnings for it. I paid 10 times earnings for it. I paid less than 10 times earnings for it. And we traded it and trimmed it when we thought it was expensive and bought more of it and trimmed it and bought more of it. And eventually made the mistake of selling the entire position and didn't fully appreciate what was going to happen with the cloud. Mm-hmm. So that's a case of one of the best businesses extant back to the mid-1980s. And there've been moments where you've made a mountain of money by buying it intelligently, but there were moments where you really harmed yourself if you were a shareholder. And again, it was the largest component of the S&P 500 and it was right there front and center. And very few wanted to consider that price mattered. And you know, most of your big mutual funds, most of your big investors had it as their largest investment. And you know, simply not owning something that overvalued, by not owning the Magnificent Seven today, I'd presume that if you own the 493 remaining companies, my bet would be that those 493 for the next decade and a half outperform the seven only for valuation. I could be wrong on that. But I think, four of the seven are probably way ahead of themselves on a price basis. In any event, price matters and it happens to matter a lot. And I think it's, however you apply it to the valuation metrics as an investor, at bottom, you've got to pay a cheap price because that's one of your margins of safety.
Now, you say price matters, and I agree 100%. And I do try to share the same message with my followers that price matters. You've talked about you've got stocks in your portfolio trading at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times earnings. Your portfolio averages a PE of 9 right now. Why is paying a low multiple so important to long-term performance, to compounded returns? And you're mathematically, in your just guesstimation, do you think it's the high starting earnings yield? Do you think it's less potential downside? Do you think it's the potential for a re-rating? Why do you think paying a low starting multiple is so important to long-term compounded returns?
Well, I think you talk about the efficient market hypothesis, which is a goofy concept from the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. The notion that the market is efficient in all forms at all times is kind of insane. I think better put, the market is extremely efficient in the very long term. It's moderately efficient in the medium term, and it's wildly inefficient in the short term, in that you can have valuation disparities. Same business, you could have an earnings miss. I mean, Dollar General, for example, traded in a range of something like $260 a share down to $101 or $102 per share. Now you've got a big earnings miss, and you know, a lot of investors don't like to own something that was supposed to earn $10 and change that's now going to earn $7 and change. So you've got a 30% hit to earnings at present. But the, so in my letter, I think it was this past year, and I may have run it for the last couple of years, I've got a table that takes our portfolio, the Semper portfolio of stocks, and it's multiple to earnings. And then of course the inverse, your earnings yield at the outset. And you can see over time, when you simply take 12/31 valuations, your subsequent returns were always higher when the portfolio was trading at the cheapest levels, at the highest earnings yields.
Yes.
Well, that's just, I mean, that's, you know, you break down the stock market into deciles or quartiles or quintiles over time, and you'll generally see that the low price, the low valuation tends to correlate with higher absolute returns over time. Again, it's not the one-off. You can't simply say, I'm going to buy something at 5x earnings, because a lot of times it's priced appropriately because you've got a business with a fundamental flaw and perhaps a permanent problem. But in an aggregate sense, you know, at a moment like this where valuations are so stretched, again, they're not stretched for the average company. And so, you know, the analyst should be able to find really good business, say, for really good prices. And by simply avoiding the places where valuation is the most stretched, should lend itself to good returns long term.
Yeah. So I saw you speak at a conference earlier this year in New York City. In fact, I flew to New York to hear you speak, Chris. Anyway, you shared some data on forward returns for high price to sale stocks. What did you learn from digging into all of that price to sales data?
Well, the data pool was enormous, and I've written about this in the letter. If you really want, if the listeners want to kind of dig into the weeds.
And I recommend they do read that letter. Yeah.
Well, thanks for that. So it goes to what we were just talking about. It goes to paying the highest price at moments in time lends to itself to the most disastrous returns over time. You've had a couple moments in the last quarter century where the absolute number of stocks, and the way we did this was broke the stock market as defined by companies that had a minimum threshold, $200 million market cap. You really needed to get away from some of the frauds and some of the pink sheets to have real investable businesses. But it wasn't just the S&P 500. It was the majority of the stock market, with the exception of the little tiny stubs. But broke it down into year-end valuations of the going into each year. So, I mean, 23 years of data, beginning at the outset of 2000. So starting at the end of 1999, stocks that traded for north of 30 times earnings, north of 20 times earnings, north of 10 times earnings, less than 10 times, and then the universe. So you've got, you know, these enormous number of portfolios, and then tracking the subsequent return of each of those groups. Now, if you were a 30 times earnings stock, you were also included in the 20 to earnings and the 10 to earnings, of course, and you're also in the universe. And so
you did this for earnings and for price to sales?
No, it was just on price to sales.
Sales. Got you.
It was only on price to sales. And so what you found was at peaks in the NASDAQ, for example, when you had the tech bubble at the end of 99, you'd had this huge run up in the number of companies that were trading at high multiples to sales, north of the group at north of 10, north of 20, north of 30. So in the ensuing bear market that unfolded from 2000 to 2002, those 3 years, the S&P was down almost 50%. The NASDAQ was down over 80%.
Yeah.
And so that group of high price to sales stocks were eviscerated. The same thing happened most recently at the end of 2021. I mean, take your Cathie Wood type portfolio of a whole bunch of businesses with no profits, but trading at their high at something like portfolio trading at 26 times sales.
Yeah.
Well, you were just destined to lose money. And so in 2022, when your S&P was off 18, the NASDAQ was down something like 35. And that cluster of companies where the multiples to sales really doubled from where you were. So you've had an absolute decline in the number of publicly traded companies over the last quarter century, but you had almost twice as many high price to sales stocks at the end of 21 versus where you had at the end of 99. And
wow,
you know, it was the avoidance at the moments where there were those clusters of high price to sales stocks that would have kept you out of trouble. And turns out the only two moments where it made sense to own the high priced companies were at the end of the washout. So, you know, at the end of 2002 and presumably at the end of last year, you'll have decent performance and decent returns. But again, if you're down 50 and you make 50, you're not back to even. If you are down 80%, you're at 20. And if you make 80% on 20, guess where you are? Run the math. It's not very good. So
not very good at all.
You know, what's interesting. So, you know, part of the takeaway there, what's so interesting is, again, I think similar today, there's a concentration of overvaluation in a handful of companies. And so the moment where it made sense to not own the most expensive, if instead of owning the S&P 500 at the outset of 2000, if you did not own the cap-weighted index, but you owned an equal-weighted index, you kept yourself out of trouble. And I think the equal-weighted S&P, we made something like 35% from 2002 when the market was down almost 50. I believe, and I don't have these numbers at hand, but I believe the equal weighted index was probably flat to maybe up over that period. So it's the moments. I mean, it to me just and you struggle with this. I mean, you think about in times like 02 or in 08, 09, where you've had a washout, and again, 07 was another period where you had a lot of high price to sales stocks, and then of course you had the Great Recession. So that would have been another moment to not own the high price group. But, we've debated long and hard when you get these brutal bear markets, does it make sense to sacrifice business quality and trade down? And we always come back to no, we're just too disciplined on quality to change horses and own lousy businesses. But your upside from a market low when everything's completely washed out is a lot higher. We just can't bring ourselves to do it. But that would be the only time where stretching on valuation would make sense. But you've got to get your timing right, and you've got to assume there's going to be some kind of a snapback. To me, it was a useful study. And you use price to sales because you do have a universe of companies that are profitless. But that's a hard game to play. I mean, trying to figure out how much top-line growth you're going to get. You take, when you start at 26 times sales, you take a portfolio, you take a business and grow the sales top line at 20% a year, assume some incredibly high profit margin, 30%, 40%, 50%, which gets you into the realm of the MasterCards and the Visas. Very few companies
handful of companies. Exactly.
Just a handful can grow that fast on the top line. Only a handful can grow to that level of profitability. And then you've got to assign 20X, 30X, 40X, 50X, to justify paying those kinds of prices, and the capital and capitalism being what it is, tends to not allow that to happen. You look at when the flows from the retail investor into various products and funds, ETFs takes place, most investors like to chase performance, and they think, well, if the NASDAQ was up 80%+ in 1999, that's where you need to be. Well, that was the moment where you should not have owned the NASDAQ. The moment where you should not have owned profitless enterprises would have been following the giant run up in 2020. But that's not how flows go. And so I think just a large part of investment success to do this for a quarter century as a firm, to do it for 33 years, a lot of what goes into being a good investor is avoiding the places where you can blow yourself up, and the wrong price can absolutely blow yourself up.
Yeah. And if you're too concentrated, it can blow up a portfolio. That was incredible. And the lecture that you gave that I saw in person was also incredible. So Chris, I've got this image in my head. I don't know if it's accurate or not, of sort of great legendary value investors that largely operate on their own without a team of analysts, perhaps even without even one analyst. And I have this image, they're sitting in their office alone in a very comfortable chair, perhaps with their feet up on their desk, just reading all day long, and occasionally writing and occasionally talking on the phone with their network. And in this group, you know, once again, I don't know if this is accurate, I'd put you and Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, Todd Combs, Ted Welscher, Guy Spier, Monish Pabrai, and maybe a few others. So my question is that accurate? Are you in an office, buried in papers, in a comfortable chair, just reading all day long? And then what are you reading? Like, what do you read first in the morning? What financial data platform are you using? Like, what does your day-to-day look like?
Interesting. Well, I think that in my case, it is right. I read all the time. And you've seen pictures of...
I should say that I've seen your office, yeah. So I cheated a little bit.
Well, you've seen pictures of Warren and Charlie over the years, literally with their shoes off and their feet on the desk.
Yep.
My legs, I can't raise them that high, but you are correct. I'm always in a leather chair, either at my desk with my feet propped up, or more of the time spent in an actual leather chair with an ottoman.
Uh-huh.
But the feet are always up. Yep. I'm having a hip replaced in 9 days, and then within a year, the opposite knee. And then within 2 years, my surgeon tells me we'll be doing the other hip.
I'm sorry to hear that. I think that's probably the result of being a college athlete.
Well, college athlete and everything that goes with that, collisions and football, sure, and surgeries and very heavy weightlifting, carrying a frame that's never been thin.
Yeah.
And I was a lifelong runner until about 6 or 7 years ago, when my left knee went bone on bone. Mm. In any event, I think it's, we were joking, but if you're going to sit around and read, and I bet I work 80 hours a week, and yep, I'm going to guess of that 60 hours a week is reading, which never has felt like work to me.
Thank you for putting numbers on that, by the way. 80 hours a week and 60 hours reading. I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, and again, it's never felt like work. And so you're right. I do spend time on the telephone. More often than not, my time on the telephone is with colleagues, peers, contemporaries at other firms. What's happened with our firm is, over the last handful of years, and perhaps it's because my letter's public now, but we have a very self-selecting client base that, if people are kooky enough to sit around and read 100 plus page letters and listen to investing podcasts, they kind of self-select into being clients. But we have clients that are as useful to me for the businesses and the industries that they're in as I think I am to them as an investor.
Yep.
So that's public company executives, that's energy traders, business owners, real estate developers. And I find catching up with these folks here and there and what they're seeing in their various businesses is of extreme utility to me. Kind of to your question about what does the typical day look like? Anymore, it starts with reaching for the phone, which I shouldn't do, intermittently throughout the night, checking. I use the Bloomberg, and I've got the Bloomberg on the phone.
Yeah.
which is crazy. I sit at my desk here with multiple monitors and reflexively find myself not logging on to the Bloomberg, but pulling up data on the phone until you realize you're losing your mind and yeah. You actually get to where your eyes can actually see things better.
Yeah.
I still read the journal cover to cover. I've gotten away from things like the FT mm-hmm. and even the Economist. Anymore, there's so much news. There's so much news flow throughout the day that most of what you see in the newspapers by the time they come in the morning, if you're not doing them online, I still get the paper copy of the journal. A lot of it are news stories you've already seen. And so there's the repetitiveness to where you just don't need that much. I mean, I used to love reading Gretchen Morgenson's work at the New York Times. Well, she's gone. And if all you're left with is Krugman, the value of that publication went in my world to less than zero. Most of my reading time, John, is on companies,
sure.
all of your government filings, your annual reports. I do use the Bloomberg if I'm working on a name. And I love the ability to go back 20, 30 years and look at summary financial statements. You can, pop up, years and years of your income statement, your balance sheets, your cash flow, and even summary statistics, which would give you market cap and enterprise value. So a lot of the yardsticks that matter over time, look at the evolving margin levels of a company, look at the evolving capital structure of a company. I find the Bloomberg to be indispensable on that front, but you could use FactSet or you can use any of the others. We just happen to have the Bloomberg and I've kind of conditioned my flow to that. There are publications that I've always read, and I gravitate toward the ones that have investment ideas. If I'm going to investment conferences, I prefer talking about companies. I mentioned this on recent podcast with William Green, but I've tried to read books on behavioral finance and I just can't get into it. Sure. My brain, for whatever reason, really enjoys challenging itself with looking at companies and comparing businesses across different industries. But there are, so for that, Kate Welling, I just did an interview with Kate again. That's just recently out. She was at Barron's and kind of invented with Alan Abelson the round table, and yep. she would do the manager interviews. Well, she's been doing that on her own platform now for a long time. If you don't see her work, she's reduced the flow, but I don't know how she did it for as many years, but she still does manager interviews and they're just chock-a-block full of ideas in the same vein. I like seeing John Hines's value in VII, Value Investing Insight.
Yep.
The students at Columbia have their Graham and Doddsville newsletter, which is usually three investors and just a whole bunch of ideas. I think I love anything Patrick O'Shaughnessy does. His Colossus now does the business breakdowns. I don't know if you've listened to those, but
absolutely. Yeah.
Those are wonderful. I've been through almost all of those. You've got some curated places that I lean on. MOI Global, John's platform there is terrific. He puts out a nice weekly curation and links to a lot of great stuff. My really good friend Joe Koster has a curation and charges very little for it, Value Investing World. So I lean on filters of some of the guys that I like and admire for things that they find interesting. I've been a lifelong paid up subscriber to Grants. I love the way Jim writes. I love the economic issues that he tackles. He gets into some companies. So I read his work religiously. He's got a great podcast out as well. And then of late, because I've been trying to get my body ready for this joint replacement since May, I've been walking at least 2 hours and 15 minutes every single day. I've lost about 50 pounds.
Awesome, Chris.
And so, if you're out, milling around and walking, what I've done is I've been a lifelong, well, lifelong at the point where companies started doing quarterly earnings calls. I literally think we invented the transcript. I could be wrong, but when we launched the firm, there were more and more companies doing earnings calls. And I would have Chad, my business partner, listen to as many calls as he could and give me bullet points on what was being said. So I was getting our own internally produced transcripts. And then FactSet came out and I don't know, I think they charged 10 grand or 15 grand for it, but that was a no-brainer. Now I get them on the Bloomberg. And so, you know, I'll take on a 2.5 hour walk, I'll take 2 hours and listen to some combination of earnings calls or and or podcasts. And then usually take 30 minutes and listen to music and just kind of reflect on what I just listened to or think about things that I need to think about, kind of a meditational process. But I love this. You know, I still read earnings calls voraciously. But I like the listening. And what I really like is being able to download these things and listen to them at 125% or 150% speed. The other thing is before I get into an earnings call, whether I'm reading it or listening to it, you'll always have gone through the press release. If for US companies, the Q is out, I always want to read whatever's already been published for the quarter before you get into the transcript, because invariably, most of these companies still will take the first 20 minutes, 30 minutes and simply regurgitate what was in the press release or what was in the earnings release or what was in the queue. And you don't need to hear the boilerplate. So I usually will kind of pick the time mark on if I'm listening to an earnings call where there's going to be utility to what's being talked about. And then, you know, usually it's the Q&A, but there's also discussion moments, and you kind of know over the years which management teams tend to talk about what and at what point. So there's an efficiency to doing that. And then the podcasting, I've not been a religious listener to podcasts only because I read so much, but now that I'm doing all this, well, and there are some that I always did like to get to, but always would try to find time for. Again, anything O'Shaughnessy does, his Invest Like the Best is terrific. I was just on William Green's Richer, Wiser, Happier. His book was outstanding.
He's outstanding overall.
He is. He's a remarkable, warm, kind human being, intellectually curious, and just a very, very good man. I had dinner with him last time I was in New York a few weeks ago, and couldn't have been more delightful. I like Stig's platform. We study billionaires. That's where William's podcast is launched, his Richer, Wiser, Happier podcast. Steve Clapham's become a good friend. I was just with him in London a while back. He came over to the Berkshire meeting this year, but his Behind the Balance Sheet is really good. A friend of mine had a young analyst take his course, which feedback was terrific. I like Med Faber stuff, the Med Faber show.
Yep.
I mentioned the Grant's podcast. Grant Williams is just a gem with all the different platforms that he has between his Endgame. He's got the thing with Steph Pomboy, who I really like, Doomberg. And then I really like Tobias and Jake and their Value After Hours and the Acquirers podcast.
Same. I've been lucky enough to be on the Value After Hours with them. They're so great.
Yeah, they're awesome. They're just a ton of fun.
Yeah.
And you know, and they get into companies. So the more of these pods that where the guests or the conversations gravitate toward companies is really what gets me excited. So there's so much of that fills the day that, and again, the majority of the time is spent company specific, but you know, all that stuff, you know, you think about structure in the day. I have a very unstructured day other than starting with, you know, once I finally put down the Bloomberg and get into the journal, I still spend a couple hours with the journal each day. But then from there, what I'm going to work on is not set. I don't have an outline at the beginning of a week saying I'm going to work on these companies. Now I know who's reporting earnings when they're reporting it. And so you've got to get through all of your own companies. You've got to get through all the competitors. And so there is a structure to when those come, because you want to get on those things as quickly as possible. But when I'm working on new ideas, it comes from all over the place. And, you know, it's a very ADD process, and that I'll wind up spending 2 or 3 days on something that I had no idea I was going to work on going into that. But you just dig a little bit, then you dig a little bit deeper and something's interesting. And the valuation might make sense, which might encourage your work on a name or an idea, but it's all over the board. But I think it's that lack of structure and just the enormous information flow with something that I'm very interested in that makes it feel like I've never worked at this thing. It's just, it's a fun thing. And I can't think of anything I'd rather wind up doing than looking at companies. It's just, it's what really excites me.
That, speaking of excitement, that was the most exciting and detailed explanation of what a master investor reads and listens to and how many hours they spend doing it that I think I've ever heard. So thank you for that. Really quickly, while we're on reading, talk to us about Value Line. That's another one of your sources. Am I right?
Yeah, I should get these guys to pay me because when I first launched myself in with an interest in investing, I find myself in the business school library at Colorado, and I found the S&P tear sheets and the Moody's manuals and the Value Line. And I've been a subscriber to Value Line my entire career, the hard copy. I tell students all the time that there's a discipline to reading the Value Line survey. And they've diminished their small cap, mid cap. Now it doesn't come with the same cadence, but you know, I get both the large cap and then the mid cap, small cap survey. Mm-hmm. There is, to me, there's an enormous utility to the way the information is presented on the page. And it's really the data. It's not so much the text about what's going on with the business, but it's the way the business, it's the way the data is presented in dollar terms, in per share terms.
Yes.
That just allows you to stay on top of a whole bunch of businesses and industries. So you know, you've got 13 editions to the Value Line, so it turns over 4 times a year. So you're seeing the same set of companies 4 times. So the cadence of it, you know, matches the reporting schedule for most companies. But you've got, you know, say 10 years of dollar revenues. You've got per share revenues and cash flows and earnings and dividends and all that back for 15 or so years. You have the share count, so you can always see, you know, if a company on a net basis is buying shares back, you can see when shares were used in a deal. You get the capital structure, very summary level capital structured, long-term debt, and then a box for all of your working capital metrics, rates of growth in per share sales and earnings and book value, 4 years or 5 years, I guess, of dollar revenues on a quarterly basis and your earnings per share. It allows you to take a couple minutes snapshot. If I'm going to go work on something, the first thing I do is pull up the Value Line page, if it exists for a company, and just try to get my mind around what's happened. It's then that you get into your filings and your annuals and your proxies and all of that. But it's, to me, as a generalist, it allows the investor and the analyst to keep up with a whole bunch of companies on a very efficient basis. So
yes,
I mean, when I fly, I don't watch movies or TV shows on my phone or iPad. I mean, my flying time is always spent just ripping through the Value Line tear sheets. And if I happen to not be flying for a few weeks, you know, I'll sit in the leather chair on a weekend and I'll spend, you know, a couple hours, 3 hours with whatever the newest edition of the Value Line is. I mean, I rarely don't take the time to go through it, and it's a refresher. And because you then get the stock price chart, you can kind of see where, you know, prices for things that you like, your universe, where things may be getting interesting or may be getting ahead of themselves. So, and I think I don't live in a digital age the way younger people do. I suppose you can apply the same discipline to the Value Line by having the digital subscription. And I have the digital. I mean, you know, if I'm going to work on a few things, I'll print the tear sheet. from the online, but it's having the tangible survey in paper form and flipping through the pages that to me is cathartic, but it's extremely efficient. It's not a replacement for all the work that has to go into a company when you're working on a company, but it's a very well thought out series of summary data that I've conditioned my brain to kind of reflexively go to the various data points that are the most important. And, you know, for it, it's made me a more efficient investor for sure.
Yeah, I would agree. I started reading Value Line back when I first read Peter Lynch's book, 20 years ago or whatever. And then, you know, Bill Nygren uses Value Line. You use Value Line. Joel Tillinghast over at Fidelity uses Value Line. And so it's this wonderful resource. Like you said, it conditions you to look at every company four times a year. And so many great investors use it. So, Chris, yeah, I have it on. Go ahead.
I was just going to add. And so the Value Line is very good with domestics and a handful of internationals, but it doesn't have the global scope that you'd want it to have. And so within a Bloomberg, for example, you can get to your key summary pages and really get to a similar thing. So, you know, I've used the Bloomberg long enough now to where you almost have the same layout with your key data points. So even though you don't have the Value Line page itself, I think you can do this without the Value Line, but there's a discipline to making yourself look at the quarterly stuff. But, you know, I'm still going to go look for the same history of the share count and revenue progression and capital structure progression, margins and margin progression over time, returns on capital and equity. So you can do it without, you can do it on the Bloomberg, but you know, I default in places where the Value Line does cover companies. It's singularly the probably the best investing tool that I've come across in a third of a century doing this, but I do it as well with the summary data on the Bloomberg. And it serves the same purpose.
Yeah. And I know you like to dive into those financial statements going back as far as you can, 20 or 30 years sometimes. Chris, I have it on pretty good authority that you recently organized for, I think, 20 or so of your close investing friends to all fly to St. Louis. And for, I think, almost a week, you and these 20 investors just got together and shared conversation and shared ideas and shared dinners and learned from each other. So first of all, just what an incredible, awesome idea that you have to organize this event and to sort of host it. But secondly, tell us about it. What do you and these other 20 investors talk about for a week all in the same city?
Well, the group's grown. We've had 30 for the last couple of years, and I don't think the format of what we try to do lends itself to a much larger group.
Yeah.
So we just had our 11th. In fact, we missed the pandemic year. So we've done it for 12 years, but this was our 11th. So yeah, I mean, so I've got a wonderful group of friends and contemporaries at other firms, who are really incredibly valuable, you know, almost a surrogate analyst team, if you will. But we get together formally for 3 days, and generally 10 or 12 of us will talk about an idea for an hour. We try to get the list of ideas pre-announced by a couple of weeks for those that really want to dig in and spend time with the filings and what have you. We start this year formally on a Tuesday afternoon, spend all day Wednesday, and then through lunch on Thursday. I'd say, a third to a half come to town early the night before. So this year, last few years, we've had dinner on Monday. We have drinks at the house and then dinner out. And, you know, another third of the group sticks around that Thursday night. So it's turned in a little bit of a marathon.
Yeah.
But we've probably averaged 12 companies, you know, 10, you know, 11 or 12. We did 15 this year just because some of the members talked about a couple different things. But it's the format. So I'm spending an hour per idea in a very collegial setting, almost Socratic, no PowerPoint presentations, nothing digital. Everybody brings a 2-page, 3-page, 5-page, whatever they want to talk about. But it's a very informal conversation. And really the genesis of this thing was the first year and the second year we did it. The idea was bring your most challenging idea, because you're going to wind up with a lot of people in the room that are a lot smarter than you are, giving you feedback and where you might be missing things. We had the misfortune, and I kind of tongue in cheek, you know, when folks start tracking how the subsequent performance of each name presented has been, it's right. turned into a more actionable format now, because nobody wants to embarrass themselves by bringing something that's going to wind up being a dud.
Right.
But, you know, we've had, you know, probably 130, let's say, different ideas presented over the course of the last 11 years, discussed in detail. It makes you spend a few weeks on those ideas. And then I think given this stealth bear market that's gone on this year of all the years, I think the majority of what was presented is, you know, immensely viable. Then you've got to run, you know, whatever's presented against your portfolio. I've only bought maybe two or three, I think, of the names that were presented over the years have made it, have found their way into the Semper portfolio, but it's just a wonderful, fun group of folks from all over the place. We keep it very private. We don't disclose the names. We don't disclose who's coming. We do not release for the public any of the handouts that the folks use. And so it lends itself to candor, and we have a lot of fun. We eat and drink really well each night. It's just a fun group, but they're, you know, and we've cultivated it to, you know, everybody that comes to this thing are kind, thoughtful, good people. I mean, they're my best friends in the world. And just the time spent over that week each year, the portion of the week is a celebration for all of us. And it's just a fun group, but there's enormous utility to it as well.
That is so awesome. So Chris, it's possible that you are one of, you know, one of the people that has studied Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway closest in the world, and you've done it for a really long time. So how would you describe Warren Buffett's investing philosophy and strategy? When you look at Apple, Occidental Petroleum, the basket of Japanese trading houses, and then even the older investments, Coca-Cola, American Express, Wells Fargo, way back in the day. What stands out to you? What does Warren Buffett look for when picking stocks based on your judgment?
Interesting. Well, he's the best of all time. The GOAT. I think if there's one commonality of the things that he buys, and this would go to the investments in common stocks and also acquisitions of businesses in their entirety. I think it's durable earning power. I mean, he's just very price conscious. I think he's looking for some durability, but more often than not, you know, he figures out twists on things that are only apparent in arrears, whether it's Johns Manville after they shed their asbestos liabilities, the Japanese trading companies being able to finance the purchase at almost 0% interest in Japan for assets that were trading at half a book, where you've got good businesses with enough volatility in these trading arms where the things were worth way more than half book, and he financed them for less than free, particularly at the moments when you look at his subsequent acquisitions, done at times where the dollar is at a very, very high level against the yen. He's that good. It's the purchase of Allegheny most recently, where Allegheny will be and is now a much, much better. And it was a good, it was a great business. Weston Hicks, phenomenal CEO. But Berkshire can do things with that, the Allegheny assets that Allegheny could not do. They can retain more of their reinsurance and PC volume without laying it off in the retrocessional and reinsurance market. They can invest the insurance reserves, the investment assets, completely differently because Berkshire has so much surplus capital in their insurance business. You can own far more long-duration common stock investments than would be the case for any other insurer on the planet. And so the thing will just be more profitable inside of a Berkshire. He's just that good. But I think what you'll find, the Apple, I mean, you know, he still owns it. He trimmed a little bit of it a couple of years ago. But he bought a really wonderful business at 12 to earnings. When he bought Coca-Cola, he did it after the stock market crash in 1987 over a period of a couple of years. Yeah. Had a $1.3 billion basis in it that by 1998, the stock was a 10 bagger in a very short period of time. But it traded from a very cheap multiple upward. When you look at the timing of the buys in the 1970s, Geico initially, before they got all of it in 95, but the Washington Post, to your point, you know, these things were bought in the 1973-74 bear market. They were bought during periods of high inflation where common stocks perform very badly, and the prices paid brought to Berkshire and brought to the portfolio an enormously high level of earnings yield. And so it's really no more complex than that. He's not a fan of paying big fancy prices for things. You know, prices generally is margin of safety. The last really big acquisition, and Allegheny was big, but the last really big deal was Precision Castparts. And he readily admit that he overpaid for it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you had so much competition coming from private equity that the notion that a Berkshire can buy a business now because the CEO wants it to be held inside of Berkshire has almost become quaint, because there's so much money and so much of a competitive auction place to a private business selling itself that, you know, the days of getting deals are probably gone for the moment. And so, you know, Berkshire's capital allocation has shifted from the big acquisition of companies in their entirety to share buybacks and purchasing common stocks for the insurance portfolio. And, you know, the bolt-on and the acquisitions here and there, like the Allegheny deal recently. And I think, you know, he said over all the years, you just can't make it more complicated than it needs to be. But he's the best at it. And like I say, there's invariably the aha moment as to when he bought the railroad, for example. The industry had been a terrible industry for a long time, for decades, didn't earn their cost of capital. And you had a regulatory change and businesses started to be allowed to earn higher returns on capital, calculating weighted average cost of capital differently. And the whole thing just went from a lousy industry to a great industry. And he was very early to figure that out. And I thought in paying $35 billion for this thing that, you know, he was going to earn 5 on capital, and turns out the things earned 12 on capital. And so, you know, with the majority of profits being upstream to the parent, having paid $35 billion for it, he's got an asset that's now worth probably $100 billion more than that over a fairly short period of time. They bought it in 09. I think it closed in early 10, but he got the economics changing before most investors did. And so he's just the best. And
it's the inflection points. It's like what you saw with the refiners. You know, you mentioned Johns Manville and them moving beyond the asbestos or the, you know, the railroad industry, consolidating and becoming a much better industry. It's these inflection points that just impresses me. And then you mentioned the earnings yields. You know, he got those trading houses for 14% earnings yields or something. So it's pretty incredible, Chris. You mentioned the shift in capital allocation more towards buybacks because of more competition for big acquisitions. When do you think Berkshire will pay a dividend?
Well, I hope never. Mm-hmm. In fact, at Grant's conference this year, one of the presenters, and I actually don't remember which one it was, Berkshire came up and he had said Berkshire has never paid even a dime in dividends. Well, truth is they actually paid a dime per share dividend in 1967.
Yeah.
One quarter paid 10 cents. And that would be, you know, it's like 200,000% higher today. So they really shouldn't have paid it. I think if, and this would be whether Warren is still running the show or not, from a capital allocation standpoint, I think if Berkshire really lacked the ability to buy businesses or given the size of the equity portfolio inside the insurance operation of over $300 billion, you know, if the overall stock market were so expensive for a very long period of time where you couldn't put money to work, I think leaning first on share repurchases as they started to do in 2018, and they bought stock back when it was cheap in the past as well. I mean, you know, they were buying the stock back in the late 1960s and again in the mid 1970s. But then went a period of, I think, 13 or 14 years where they didn't buy a share back. But then starting in 18, they ramped up the buybacks to where they're pushing $70 billion now cumulatively. You look at where the valuation is, and he's buying earnings yield, and always from an opportunity cost standpoint. And I think that's where you see when the share repurchases go up, tends to be at times when the stock is inexpensive. Last year, 2022, the majority of capital allocation, in fact, far more than investable cash flow, went to a net purchases of common stocks. This year, they've been a net seller of common stocks, and the cadence of share buybacks is not as high as it was back in 2020 and 2021. But, you know, he sits there, Mr. Buffett sits there really investing through a lens of opportunity cost. And he's going to do the very best thing with capital at the moment. And I think if the levers of capital were diminished to the point where you can only spend so much growth CapEx in the energy operation, if private equity and all this money sloshing around drives cap rates down to such low levels and earnings yields down to such low levels that the control premium that you'd have to pay to buy entire businesses, you know, if there were no opportunities on that front. And then if Berkshire's stock itself was expensive, which it's not today, but if it was expensive, then I think you'd see them distribute dividends, and most likely would be done via special dividends at the outset and not a regular dividend, because Berkshire's always going to be the opportunistic investor that always wants to have dry powder in place when the rest of the world goes haywire. They'll be the buyer of last resort because they do have the Fort Knox balance sheet, and you never want to diminish that. And so for that, you know, you're running over $1 trillion in assets now, tangible assets, which is incredible.
The largest company by assets, I believe.
With the exception of banks and sure, what have you, but in terms of tangible assets, non-financial assets, yeah, by far, yeah, the biggest. Yeah. You've not seen a diminution of the earning power of the franchise, which means they've been able to put all of these retained earnings, which is the entirety of what Berkshire is, has come from retained earnings over all these years.
It's the ultimate growth company, right? It's retaining 100% of its earnings for its history.
They have, they've tended not to blow up capital. I mean, right, the big mistakes are few and far between. And even going back to the original textile business and to the diversified retailing and blue chip stamps, you know, those businesses all essentially went to zero, but it was the diversion of capital away from businesses that were producing cash flow, but those businesses that were in decline, the recognition that those businesses were in decline, not throwing more capital after them, but diversifying that capital into places with durable earnings yields, durable earning power, is just extraordinary. And you've not seen the returns on this thing decline since they bought Gen Re in 1998. you know, they're still putting money to work at 10 to 12%, which until they can't do that, there'd be no reason in my mind to pay a dividend. It's one of the most tax efficient investment vehicles around because the taxable investors not being hit on a tax levy for dividends paid. And to the extent it can maintain its returns on equity capital at a sufficiently high level, unless our government screws up the tax code, as was contemplated by the current administration during the prior election cycle, if for a U.S.-based investor, if we continue to enjoy the tax basis step up at death, you can own Berkshire for a lifetime, never pay a dime of tax, and never pay a dime of estate tax with it. Now, at a point, it gets so big and so unwieldy that it will be harder and harder to put the money to work. And when you think about the ability to buy back shares when they're cheap, the ability to invest in stocks for the insurance operation, to find places, all these utilities and these distribution assets they've bought in energy, where they can spend north of $5 billion a year building out renewable portfolio, building out the grid that goes with it. Finding these places where you can put money to work at good, acceptable returns, they're still very, very good at it. And it's so overcapitalized, so conservatively run in terms of the balance sheet that it's a very safe place. I like to say it's almost like a bond that's yielding 10 to 12% when you buy it at the right prices.
Extremely tax efficient bond. Yeah. You mentioned the distribution assets, the utilities, the railroads. Chris, is accelerated depreciation from the capital intensive businesses and the deferred tax liabilities that creates, is that still a meaningful source of float for Berkshire Hathaway?
Oh, it is. And I've had folks push back on me on the materiality of it and whether it really exists. I mean, when you're spending CapEx and depending on where the tax code is at the moment, I mean, there was this last handful of years, and this is running out this year and next year. But you know, any CapEx, all companies got to enjoy the use of accelerated depreciation for the books. Companies keep two sets of books, the GAAP accounting books and then the tax books. And so there is a timing differential between, you know, fully depreciating an asset very quickly on the front end, and then eventually you are going to pay the tax, but there is the use of that money over time. You know, Berkshire has an $80+ billion net deferred tax liability on the balance sheet, half of which, let's say, comes from these capital intensive businesses, the railroad and the utility operation. But from a materiality standpoint, it's about $1.5 billion as I do the math. And you've got a business that's earning power is pushing $60 billion. I don't know where it's going to be this year, 56, 57 billion when I do my annual update. So it's not huge, but within the energy operation, it's a big deal. And within the railroad, it was a big deal. Berkshire's, the railroad, the BNSF is not increasing track miles. And so a lot of the ability for the rail to spend money on its own infrastructure, building out track in the kind of the urban corridors, you know, leaving Los Angeles, the most dense traffic mileage, adding capacity there, blowing out all the tunnels in the west to accommodate intermodal, you know, the double stacking of containers. Mm-hmm. A lot of that's run its course, and so you don't have as much what I'd call growth CapEx now in the railroad, but you sure do have it in the utility operations. And it's meaningful. I mean, it's worth 15 to 20% additional profitability for the energy operation than what's reported on a GAAP basis. But in the entirety of Berkshire, if you wanted to presume that it's, so what, time value money, don't count it, then take $1.5 billion out of what I'd call my economic earning power of Berkshire. So it's enough to move the needle on a standalone basis in the places where it's applied, but for the whole, the entirety of Berkshire, it's not that big of a deal.
One of the competitive advantages of Berkshire as a holding company is that it can move cash between subsidiaries in a very tax efficient manner. So my question is, do you think Berkshire will ever break up? And would you support it breaking up at some point in time.
No, I think the conglomerate structure and the way Berkshire is put together, there are so many businesses. I talked about Allegheny just a while back. There are so many businesses that exist inside of Berkshire that are better off inside of Berkshire. Kind of to your point, capital can find its way to the places where it can be most attractively deployed. I think with Greg now running the operations side of Berkshire, you know, Mr. Buffett has no direct reports. I think there's a lot more accountability. It's probably the wrong word, but I think there's a lot more accountability to the individual businesses in terms of how they're operated. I think there's an encouragement now for places where you've simply deferred sending your profits to Omaha because, you know, who am I to invest where Omaha does it so well? I think they're looking for places to put money to work.
Yeah.
Bolt-on acquisitions, growth capex, things like that. So no, I think about, you know, if you broke it up, if you wanted an immediate boost to your earning power, if my sum of the parts valuation is correct, then the standalones of the energy operation, the railroad, the manufacturing service retail businesses, and the insurance operation, I think you'd make the case that they're collectively worth a heck of a lot more than the whole today. But if you're in this thing for, you know, more than a breakup value, the ability for Berkshire to pull the capital levers intelligently is best done under current structure. I mean, I don't want the railroad standalone. You know, I don't want the energy operation standalone. They're way better off inside of Berkshire. You can use the tax books to your advantage across the enterprise. No, I really, you know, I'm 50. I'll be 55 here on Saturday. You know, if I get the same run as Charlie, if I make it to 100, you know, another 45 years on, I'd like to think Berkshire can continue, you know, over the next, you know, 45 years. Remains to be seen as it gets larger and larger, whether it'll be possible or plausible. But it kind of goes back to the earlier conversation about whether they should pay a dividend. At a point, they probably will pay a dividend, but only on recognition that the opportunity sets are diminished and the stock itself is not inexpensive.
Chris, 55 years old. Happy early birthday. You are a value investing legend. Well, you're one of the investors I admire most and that I try to learn from most. I read every word of your 100-page letters. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Any plans to slow down, retire? You said you're working 80-hour weeks. So where do you see yourself?
Well, I hope I'm doing the same thing. I've told our clients that we'll never sell the business. And ideally, they take me out in a pine box as long as my brain works. You know, I see, and you see it all the time. You see folks that are very successful in business, but that retire and go to the golf course every day. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think keeping the brain occupied on and keeping it challenged is one of the keys to longevity.
Yes.
You know, I think Charlie is just as sharp now as he's been at any point. The cadence of your speech slows. I've talked about our anchor client and, you know, the cadence of his speech pattern would slow, but his brain was hard charging and almost made it to his 100th birthday, but he was engaged. He was in the office. He was starting businesses. So, you know, knock wood, 55 years young, I hope, not old. That my body and my brain allow me to do this thing for as long as I can. I can't imagine having any more fun doing anything else other than what I happen to be fortunate enough to be able to do.
Chris, I'm knocking on wood as we speak. I am going to sneak in one more. Any plans to bring on an analyst at any point in time?
Yeah, we had an analyst. In fact, analysts wound up working in Chicago for your second interview in this series.
Yeah.
And he was phenomenal. Interned with us for his final year of college. was really the captain of his CFA research challenge team.
Wow.
Was the CIO of the student-run portion of the endowment at his school, and not a headline school or university by any long shot. And then worked with us for almost 5 years and wound up with a great opportunity to make a lot more money than he was immediately going to make with us. And he's working for a wonderful shop now with a differently run. It was, again, your second podcast guest, a lot more structure. I told him when I hired him, you know, there's not going to be a lot of structure here. You're going to have to be very self-sufficient. I'm not a great boss in that I'm not hands-on on a daily basis. And so, but there was enormous utility to having an analyst on board because it allowed you to maintain a larger coverage universe of the things you want to keep your arms around, your mind around. Huge help on data pulls. I mean, my ability at this, what now is an advanced age in terms of doing things like running complicated spreadsheets or massive data pulls from Bloomberg, you know, there's a skill set there that you need somebody that's better with the current technology. And so I hate to say it on this thing because I'll probably get a million resumes, but I'm working on a couple opportunities now, but I like the concept of having an analyst on hand. There's huge utility to process for having another set of eyeballs and another set of hands on, you know, whatever project you happen to be working on. And so, if I listened to those first two interviews with Nygren and O'Keefe. And, you know, I even told you, I'm not sure we should do this podcast because, you know, there's no structure to what I do. And, you know, those shops are incredibly structured and, you know, they have processes that work for them. What I don't envision happening here would be a team of a dozen analysts, each with individual industry cover. To fit inside what we do, you've got to be a generalist and there's going to be less discipline to structure. You're not going to work on precisely the same thing. I mean, there's not going to be a workflow plan for an analyst for what exactly you're going to do for the next week or the next 2 weeks or that day. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to work on the things that need to get worked on, but at the same time, we're going to approach it with an eclecticism that it works for us at least. So I will fill that seat, but it's going to have to be the right person.
The J-Row Show studies process in all of its forms. And while yours may be unstructured or less structured than some others, it is definitely a proven process that leads to long-term outperformance. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been such a privilege getting to know you over the past couple months. You've been so generous with your time and your teachings. I can only hope that this podcast did you and your brand of opportunistic value investing justice, because I do truly consider you one of the greats. So thank you, Chris.
Well, it was fun to do this with you. Good luck with the show. I think the niche that you're carving out is really interesting to a lot of people. And so I'm glad you're doing it. It was fun to be with you today.
Thank you for that. Before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder. Anything discussed on the J-Row Show by myself or my guest is solely our own opinions and does not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. The J-Row Show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed in the podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next time.